once again with the lovely Lizzie Skernick, who is most recently the author of Shelf Discovery. Lizzie, how are you doing?
I'm great.
I actually want to start by your observations when you reread Bridge to Terabithia. You point out that the class distinctions were more pronounced when you read it these days, as opposed to when you read it as a kid. Yeah. And I'm wondering if being aware of things such as the class distinctions and the sort of interesting additional levels that these books worked at had more to do with your experience now as a reader, reading lots of books and literature in your adult years to train you to look at these additional themes and motifs, whether the motifs were things that you wanted to see there, perhaps, as an adult, or whether, in fact, there is a sort of ethical debate about just how much some of these books sneak in when we're at a sort of susceptible age. What are your thoughts on this, Ms. Skernick?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I don't actually think they sneak in anything. I think on the author's part there, you know, if you look at the Ramona books, you know, there's really whole chapters about the father losing his job, the mother working, you know, many, many, many of the books I read, there's issues around the mother's working. You know, like it's actually several plot points hang on the fact that mothers have said to their husbands, screw you, you don't make enough money, I'm getting a job. I'm sorry that makes you uncomfortable. You know, it's 1979 and like I need a job or whatever. So I think it's deliberate. I think the authors are being completely straightforward. I don't think they're being strategic, but I think as a child, you do, I mean, for instance, in Bridge to Terabithia, you know Jess is poor. But you don't realize, like, I don't think I noticed about the hippie teacher, you know, and why the town disliked her. So it's like you understand what's going on, but you understand it as a child understands it. You sort of experience it. Whereas an adult, you really look and you say, oh, you know, she was writing about there was a teacher they disliked because she had long hair and she didn't wear makeup. And, you know, and they associated her with these new sort of yuppies who came in, and you can sort of see them for what they are.
Yeah.
Whereas as a child, I think when you read a book like that, you experience it as you're sort of within it. Just like how if you and your neighbors moved and were different, you'd sort of notice that girl had new, you know, laces on her sneakers, the kind that your mother never got to buy you. But you might like, you know, you would just sort of feel it alongside this character you were reading. You wouldn't be able to stand outside of it and look at it.
I'm wondering if, in the course of some of your peregrinations into these books, whether you had possibly considered going straight to the source in some cases to find out if such auctorial intentions created these grand potential allegories, whether they were just reflecting the world around them at the particular time. I mean, again, this goes back to an ongoing question that I've thought about really how much we bring in our own perceptions into a book versus the author's intentions. And so
I have a different question that I always ask. That's
sure.
My ongoing question, which is how much does an author have to do with the work they wrote? You know, because I think particularly in the cases of these books, you know, I think there are authors, this is the sort of question I've always been interested in. I think there are authors who certainly marry their subconscious with their intent. They're able to work that way. They say, you know, oh, I'm writing The Great Gatsby. Okay, those sunglasses, those are the eyes of God. I'm going to do eyes of God things, you know. And so some can sort of tease out whatever their subconscious is doing and work with it, whereas other authors are just sort of bolt from the blue. But I think either way, my personal belief is that it's often useless to ask an author what they were doing or why they were doing it, because a good piece of work becomes its own thing. And as a reviewer, I'm interested in talking to authors for other reasons. I'm sometimes interested, but I'm not as interested in them. You know, I'm really interested in the works that they've created. And I don't think that I don't always think my particular insights, you know, if you asked me a question, why do you write this or why do you do that, I don't know. You know, and some authors do think of themselves more and they're more aware of themselves. But I would never go to Katherine Patterson and say, did you mean to do that? Except as a question of interest, because I think there would be a very good chance that she could tell you and it would be correct and you'd have the answer to your question. And then there would be a very good chance she would tell you something and it actually wouldn't be true. You know, so that's, well, that's my thinking on that. Not meaning to not be true.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're really, the subconscious is very heavily at work and in all good pieces of art. That's what it's for.
Yes.
So who knows what it's, you know, you make up a story for what you were trying to do later, but who knows what you're trying to do?
Well, then I'm going to go ahead and put my own particular questions of interest to you. Okay, the concern for redheads in your review of The Moon by Night. The author who has the redheaded stepchild in a gift of magic. Yes. I'm sorry, my handwriting is terrible. But I found out last night that there are, in fact, a streak of redheaded people in your family. Yeah. And so as a result, I must put forth the psychological question to you, Miss Skernick, whether this preoccupation with redheads reflects this familiogenetic scenario.
Oh, well, look, it's hilarious because I don't know if you noticed this at the party, because not all of my friends were at the party, but my grandma Dora was a redhead. My father is a redhead. My aunt Francine is a redhead. Growing up, one of my good friends, Becky, was a redhead. And I think I had another good friend who was a redhead. And throughout my life, it's hilarious. Two of my dearest friends, Casey and Jane, are redheads. I think, you know, I have dated many redheads. And my new nephew, Asher, is a redhead. So I think certainly, like, you know, I have a huge streak of redheadedness in my life. And I could not tell you why. And it is actually funny because whenever I write about, you know, Meg's boyfriend, Calvin, is redhead. And when you, and there's quite a few redheads in Lengel in general. You know, Polly Hymnia is a redhead, Calvin's daughter. And when you write about it, there's always a few girls in the comments who'll go, oh, Calvin, I love a ginger. Like, so, you know, if you do it with Prince William and his brother, you'll get that too. So yeah, there is some that is a theme in my life, but it is also a theme in YA.
Yeah,
it's a huge theme in YA, and I don't know. I guess it's because I've never understood this because, as I said, there's zillions of redheads in my life. But redheadedness in society does always, it's like you are marked, you know, as a very different thing. Everybody looks at redheads. You know, when Asher, my nephew, was born, it was the first thing five people told me. And then when people looked at him, they would say, he's a redhead. You know, that's like the first thing. And so I guess it's often a little bit what the author is talking about, you know, this sense of being deliberate, you know, put outside. And then what do you do with that? What do you do with the fact that you are an individual? You know, redheads are forced from a very young age to be individuals in the way that we are not. And I think maybe that's...
Well, I was a redhead, you know.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, they're drawing a generalization here. I'll let you continue, but I'm curious to hear your answer.
Well, all of the redheads in my life actually are like fire red. It's like it doesn't go away. Like, I actually have some red in my hair, although, I mean, you can't tell right now because it's wet. But I think that's why that it appears in the book so often. To launch the discussion of discussing what happens when you are unique in a way that some people will think is bad and some people will think is good, which is a situation all of us are in.
Yeah.
But if you use redheadedness as a characteristic to talk about it, you get there faster.
But your significance attached to red hair goes back to our initial question about maybe something that was a throwaway reference for L'Engle or is to us possibly more significant because, red hair. I mean, it goes back to the endless questions of semiotics and what the reader actually sees and whether they're in fact...
Well, you're the one who brought up this.
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, I'm trying to test the sort of various hypotheses that are in the air. So,
no, I think redheads do figure significantly. I mean, I think you could absolutely, if you felt like it, do like a concordance of it in YA literature. There's a lot of redheads. There's a lot of girls who are readers. The way that a character, I mean, those are two characteristics that figure very. And there's a few more. Yeah, Pippi Longstocking. There's some other funny ones that I've written about in the column that I can't remember now, but there are quite a few things that crop up again and again that are bizarre.
Well, while we're on the subject of asking the author her intentions, have been meaning to ask this question of you for quite a while, and I didn't get to ask it to you last time, and that is your propensity for all caps, which is more applicable to these particular columns than, of course, your poetry. I must ask you, it's whittled down a little bit in the Jezebel columns, but it's still there. There are often sections where entire phrases are written in all caps, so I must ask you about this particular stylistic tick.
I don't know where that came from. And as you both know, you and I have both been blogging for a long time. And that was just something I did. And I know there were other bloggers that did it. And I don't know whether it was mutual or whether I was influenced. Although I have to say, I don't think I was influenced, because it would really be a tick that persisted for a very long time if it was just a question of influence. But I think maybe, I really don't know. I do it in my emails too.
Yeah.
And it's, It's like all tics, I have no idea where it comes from. And maybe, okay, if you're going to make me start analyzing myself, maybe it's that I was...
This is psychoanalyst, you know.
I'll sit, I'll do it for 4 seconds, I don't care. I think maybe it's that I was raised to be fairly modest. The same time that I was raised to be a competent performer simultaneously... Both from different parents, both who felt that each was a good way to be. And so maybe it's that I can only speak energetically in an ironic sense. So...
Not in a sincere, direct sense?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you were being energetic in the course of this conversation directly.
You've been ironic
the entire time.
No.
I feel betrayed. I feel like I should go ahead and plunge myself into the Spy magazine back catalog. My God, Lizzie.
No, in person, I'm very enthused in person. That's my whole thing. But no, I think maybe that's why it is. It's that in the writing that's what's coming out. This idea of I want to be enthusiastic and I want to sort of put forth myself, but I have to somehow couch it. So you put it in caps, and then it's sort of like I am enthusiastic, but I'm also being a goof.
Well, there was one fascinating aspect or observation you made that was not in all caps, but that nevertheless caught my attention and made me rather alarmed by your finding, and that was in your Richard Peck "Are You in the Home Alone" review. You're pointing out that Are You in the House Alone? I'm sorry.
Yes.
You pointed out that a good deal of television during the time, sitcoms, dealt with this notion of rape.
Well, that's the problem. It didn't deal with it. I wish it had dealt with it.
Yeah.
But it actually... I'm sorry, I didn't interrupt you.
It featured rape.
It was... it was in that, creation of the very special episode, and it was this idea of, it was like, rape. Something about rape and culture. And so then they just went and took every character... and raped them every show. They literally raped... Dee Dee was raped on Hunter. Yeah.
I remember that one, sad to say, and it never occurred to me. Now, as an adult, I can look back on that and say, my God, where the hell was Fred Dwyer?
It was like extraordinarily... These were not dramatic shows. It wasn't... And frankly, when they raped Dr. Melfi on The Sopranos, I also was just like, what the hell did you do that for? In what narrative arc is it important that Dr. Melfi gets raped in that show? And what was learned from it was so... It was like, the idea of raping Dr. Melfi, if you sort of look into that show, was so that you realize there's ways in which she might seek Tony Soprano's protection. That was the whole point of that rape. They can't figure out another way to do that but to rape the doctor. And I guess it was something I loved about Are You in the House Alone is that it's a story. It does actually take you through all... It genuinely took you through all the implications of the rape. And I remember... I think that's what was traumatic to me as a child about all those rapes on the shows, is that they didn't fit the narrative. Here's Tootie on... what's that show?
Facts of Life.
And this is a prime time... insipid sitcom about girls in a
school. One of the worst sitcoms ever made.
Yeah, and it's fine, but it's like, it's goofy. And then all of a sudden they're sticking her in a bathroom at a, you know, a truck stop, and she's getting molested.
Yeah.
And it was as if they sort of came into the houses. To me, it was, I really think it was traumatizing, actually, yeah. that they did that. I mean, they might as well have come along and raped all of our best friends the yeah. next day. Like, sort of like, oh, in your happy, innocent life, by the way, you're yeah. probably going to get raped. Just enjoy that. And so I think what was important maybe about the Peck book, why I remember it, is that books like that were such... You know, that, and also Happy Endings Are All Alike, which is another book with about rape, that sort of, they weren't trying to be very special episodes. I think Scott Pitone and Peck were both actually very interested in this topic. Yeah. What actually happens in a girl in a community gets raped? What happens to her life?
Yeah.
And since the authors were genuinely interested in it, I mean, I don't know what I would have done if I hadn't also been able to read books like that yeah. all the time.
But I think your connection is particularly perspicacious, because I should point out that by using
the
phrase...
You like words with P's.
Yes, I do. you know, I can talk about preoptic things as well. But anyway, we'll get into that later. But no, but actually, you are absolutely right to point out that the special episode quality of these ongoing television series, which, oddly enough, coincided with the rise in after-school specials,
yeah.
which
and
dealt
Reagan.
With rape very frequently. Yeah. And, of course, where did the after-school specials come from? Well, they went to source material often,
yeah.
YA books
yes.
at the time.
Yes.
And so I think you're absolutely right to point to this particular connection. And I'm wondering if...
Are You in the House Alone was made into an after-school
yeah.
special.
It was.
Yeah, it was. And there was one other one, too. But that may have been... wasn't where I first saw the book, but I saw it alongside of seeing that.
Yeah.
I remember. Yeah. Huh. And then there was that Mariel Hemingway movie.
Not Star 80.
No, not Star 80. I know the name of it. I can't remember the name of it. It'll come to me.
I could tell you things about Mariel Hemingway that would probably offend you. But anyway, I will keep those
maybe
to myself.
Maybe it was also Star 80. I don't think so, no. It was. It'll come to me.
I was curious because you often pinpoint the collected works of one particular author for many of these columns, like L'Engle, Bloom, of course, Lois Duncan. Mm-hmm. I'm curious why you tend to stick with one particular author and their complete oeuvre, so to speak.
Why do I... Oh, you mean why do I review so many books
of one particular author as opposed to spreading the wealth around?
Well, when I started this column, I was a little bit... I mean, what's odd about this is that... I mean, it's nice. It's nice that people pay attention to what you do. But you, you know, also people would ask me to do things. You know, my friend Elizabeth has now castigated me so heavily for not doing A Summer to Die.
Wow.
I'm going to do it this Friday. I was like, maybe it's my summer to die. I really
yeah.
better get on this book and do it. So on the one hand, you know, you have all this sort of reader response, but then also... I would try to think, maybe I should do a more mainstream book next week. And then I would do it, and it would get like 7,000 views. And
yeah.
then I'd be like, okay, I'm just going to do this random book that I like. And it would get like 14,000 views. So I was like, you know, I don't know who likes anything. And also, I think the best way for me to do this column is always to be doing a book I'm joyful and interested in at that moment.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And to not overthink it. And so that did mean, I mean, I would happily... I would just sit and write about L'Engle for weeks and weeks, just like I would sit, like I was talking with some people last night about Roald Dahl. I would sit and write, not even his children's books, his adult books,
yeah.
his amazing stories. So I think just in terms of the choices I made, I just had to let it go. So if I, and I also always am interested in authors as a body of work, which is another thing depending on your take as a reviewer. Some reviewers do the opposite, see each work stands alone, and some reviewers are interested in the body of work. I've always been the body of work kind of reviewer. I really want to know, like, what is the scope of this author's work? What are they trying to do? You know, it's like I was fascinated because I loved We Need to Talk About Kevin. But then, you know, when I read... What's wrong with me that I can't remember anyone's name this morning?
What, Lionel Shriver?
Lionel Shriver, yeah. I was like, I know she's behind me. I can't remember her name right now. But,
Have you met her, too? She's really interesting.
I've never met her. She seems fantastic.
Very, very, like, you know, I love her. She's just, like,
yeah.
really, like, just... Oh, man, I do not suffer fools gladly. It's
yeah,
great,
yeah.
yeah.
She seems like she'd be that way from her books. But, you know, when I read the latest book, which I really enjoyed. But
Post-Birthday World, yeah.
Yeah, but if you read the tennis book, her first book.
Point.
Double fault.
Sorry, let me get this up. Match point, right?
Yeah, double fault.
Damn Woody Allen.
So, but it's very similar to the Post-Birthday World. And so which I do think is a, you know, or King, Stephen King.
Yeah.
How can you talk about how good a writer Stephen King is in some ways if you don't read everything he's written? And A, just get a sense of how astonishing that is to actually be able to write so many readable books. Yeah. You know, so many. I mean, he never gets any credit for that. But also, you know, you take something like The Dead Zone, The Shining, you know, it's more pared down stuff. You really, it's like seeing a person who's sometimes very fat and sometimes very thin, and then they dye their hair, and then they do this, and they sort of look better or worse during various guises. Yeah. And in any case, I'm sorry, that's a very long answer to the question of that I think of authors related to their whole bodies of work, and that's why you see that.
I also must ask why you decided to review Clan of the Cave Bear a second time, because of course you had a guest contributor review it, and then all of a sudden, well, wait a minute, I have to weigh in on this. What happened here?
No. It actually wasn't that. I had already reviewed. I do a second column, Shelf Pleasuring, for Jezebel, and I had already reviewed it, and but before Cecily wrote about it, and then Cecily said, I think she was originally going to do a different book. And I can't remember what it was. And then she said, well, can I do Clan of the Cave Bear? And I said, sure, because I really wanted the contributors to do books they wanted to do.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't want to be like, I'd like it if you do blah. You can't, like, write about these books that way. And then I just figured that I would leave mine out of the book, you know. But then I just asked my editor. I mean, I think when I handed the book in, she was sort of like, I think it's fine to have it twice. And I was like, terrific. Because we actually, I mean, I think you could do an entire book just of women writing about, you know, and maybe that's also the point of why I just went ahead and left it in. Because everybody would write a different essay. And everyone writes these essays differently. And I think a book, essays responding to any book, it's not, you know, nothing is the definitive word on the subject. You know, and so it was as if I was so interested in what Cecily had to say. But as it happens, I also like my essay on that. Like, sort of one of the essays that I really enjoyed writing. And if I'd had time, I would have thrown in an essay on The Mammoth Hunters instead, which is a book I had reread recently and has much more to do about. I always say Isla. And I think it's Isla. It might be Ayla.
I've heard Ayla and Isla.
I think it's Isla.
As someone who read the first
two. I'm calling it an Isla. I think it's Isla. But that had much more to do with her being a moral, and also that's the funny one where it's like everywhere she goes, she's amazing, she's wonderful, you know, she's like riding lions. And that book has a lot of funny stuff too, but I really just didn't have time. Because, you know, after a certain point, everyone thinks, you know, when you write a book like this, you have, like, all the time in the world to sift through it. But it was the kind of thing where I was like, I don't think this book will be better if I curate it endlessly. I think I could write 100 different books arranged in 100 different ways about these books. And I have to just have fun. I have to not get caught up. I just know many, many authors who get very caught up in curating their own work. And I think if you're Madison Smart Bell, that's great. Like, I think if you're a certain kind of author, you know what you're doing. You know how much time you need. That's wonderful. But I think it's a very dangerous trap for your average person to kind of, you know, I really just had to say to myself, you know, I don't think it will be an improved book. I think it'll be a different book. So I'm going to just let it go with what it is right now. And if I want to write a second one, I'll write a second book and I'll fix the problem.
But your choice of the Earth's Children books is quite interesting, because those aren't actually YA books. Although many of us did read them in junior high school and the like during that time for some reason, largely for the reasons that you state in your piece and Cicely's piece as well. So I'm curious as to how flexible the formula, so to speak, is? Does it have to be a book that you read during that time that you're rereading now? Like, how does Jean Aoul actually make her way into the equation when, say, Stephen King does not, or something along those lines?
Well, I got, when the column started, I got a few notes from purists being like, you know, nothing's fair in fifth grade. It's technically middle grade. It's not way.
And the I was like, taxonomist crowd, yeah.
Yeah, and it was just like, these categories were made up by people with something to sell. And that's, and libraries, actually, I shouldn't be rude. I mean, partly the categories were made up for the Library of Congress and for libraries to have a way to effectively reach teachers and librarians. And that's a whole different story, which is a useful thing. But it's like, I'm not going to be driven by fucking sales categories on this book that I'm writing, which is that that's not how children read. Children, you know, also, there wasn't a category of YA. That this thing didn't really exist in the 70s and 80s. I mean, it started to exist, but this, I was talking about this with Scott Westerfeld the other day. This whole category of teenagehood was a created thing, you know, this idea that there should be literature for teenagers, literature about teenagers, literature that helps teenagers grow. And I don't think that's a bad idea, but I also don't think that's what these books were. They were books authors wrote, and many times, and mystery writers will tell you this too, you know, this was packaged in XYZ way. I just wrote a book. Robert Cormier was always very insistent on that. I write books. They yeah. sell them as YA, whatever. Like, I get a lot of fans that way. I like that. But I'm not sitting here writing for teens. Nowadays, people do explicitly write for teens, you know, and I think there's benefits and drawbacks to all of that. But my point is that this was not a book about my sitting down and being like, what is YA? What's middle grade? What's adult books? I wanted to write a book about how I read as a child, and I knew that part of the way I read as a child was that I took books off my parents' shelves, and that my friends did too, and that that was part of my childhood reading. That was part of my YA. And so when I started the column Shelf Pleasuring, girls were really into it. I shouldn't say girls were women, but I'll say girls were really into it. You know, and everyone was like, do Scruples, do, you know, my personal favorite was Jaws. You know, Jaws was like, I love that book. I mean, I'll reread Jaws like on a dime. But I think that's why, because I was being scrupulous about how a child reads, not about how publishers have decided to market their books during. I mean, Graham Greene, you know, who's so revered nowadays, used to frickin' sell in the airports for like 35 cents. You know, so you can't worry too much about how people are being sold at any given time.
On the other hand, I'm going to slightly disagree with you, because I remember the Scholastic sales. Remember those? They had the every, like,
the book clubs? The ones?
Yeah, no, every 2 months you have the guy with the, or the person with the Scholastic, you have the book fair, and you could buy all these books, and there was a little catalog, you remember this?
Yes.
Where you could buy for like 50 cents, you can get a paperback, you know, and it would be like one, you remember this?
We had Weekly Reader.
Oh, well, okay.
We had two things. We had the Weekly Reader catalog, which we got, I think, every 3 months, and it was exactly that. You had books, and you could buy X, Y, Z, many, you know, you had a little thing, and you filled them in, and I think, I don't even know if they gave you a budget. But maybe our parents had given us budgets of like $10 or whatever. And then twice a year in my school, at least, it was like a public school, we had the book fair when I was in elementary school. And I guess you're right. I guess those were Scholastic.
Yeah, and they were marketed. I mean, you couldn't get Graham Greene with those, but they often had some very fishy, like, rock and roll biographies and the like. I mean, I remember reading.
Maybe in California.
In California, we did.
Not in New Jersey.
Oh, you missed these. We had, like, there was these rock and roll biographies, and they were written in the 60s, and they were like, these very thin volumes, and they had these psychedelic covers on the front. Oh, it was great.
Did not have them.
You didn't have those.
Oh, no.
But they also had like the, like, yes.
When you said fishy, I literally thought I pictured like a fishing
guy.
Oh,
well.
Because that's the kind of thing we would have had. That would have been the odd thing they stuck in, you know, some they would put in like crafts books, maybe like, you know, how to fix your plumbing, how to do that.
Like, they had a whole bunch of those for 35 cents. That was part, but mostly they were like these fiction, these what we would now call YA titles. All the Beverly Cleary books were there, all the, you know, How to Eat Fried Worms,
I have How to Eat Fried Worms over there, and people have asked for it many times, but I haven't done it yet because that's a real book of our era. If you talk to a 25-year-old, they haven't read it. If you talk to a 45-year-old, they haven't read it.
Yeah.
And my column already skews so 35.
Yeah.
That I mean, it's extraordinarily, you know, and sometimes women will write in and they'll be like, Lizzie must be exactly my age. These books were not on the, I mean, it's funny that you're talking about book fairs because I do think, I mean, obviously it was before Amazon, it was before POD, but, these books were not on the shelves very long. You know, when I would go to my local bookstore, which my mother would take me to maybe once or twice, maybe once a month, once every, it would be a completely new crop of books on the shelf, which was great for me. You know, and if you waited another 6 months, you know, there's a Bat and Bug 5 would have followed the Kenny and My Gypsy, you know.
But you had to barter with kids at libraries. I mean, this is what I had to do. You had to borrow, okay, you can read this Beverly Cleary. Can you finish it in a week so I can check it out?
Yeah.
We did deals like that in my neighborhood because, I mean, we couldn't afford the damn 35 cents for the paperbacks and all that.
No, but my mother was actually, it's part of the reason I dedicated the book to her. She was actually very, I think owning books is important. You know, I think libraries are very important, but I also think children should own their own books. I think both are important. And my mother had been an English professor and a reader, and she did encourage, you know, she bought me books, and she also, books were not so expensive then. I mean, for $20 you could get 20 books, and of course $20 was a lot more then, which is not to say, I mean, 20 probably felt more like 50 or 60 in 1979, but also that's still a lot of books to get, you know, which nowadays you just can't.
Well, there was also a reading culture. We had readathons all the time. I mean, you get extra credit, and then actually they would conveniently tie these in with the Scholastic guy coming hawking his books, which is a great way for them to make some money.
Right.
It's like this. It's kind of like, okay, you get to read for like pleasure. But on the other hand, there's a sort of like, yeah, wait a minute. Actually, if you think about it, there's a way to profit off of, like, you know, working class neighborhoods and the like. My God.
So
David Simon should write some sort of great conspiracy sort of miniseries on this. But actually, while we're on this subject, I actually want to bring what has been a minor source of controversy attached to your book, recently singled out by the great Mr. M.A. Ortofer.
Oh, yes, I haven't had a chance to respond. I was going to actually respond in print. I hope he doesn't think I didn't read his review, because I certainly did. I just haven't responded to you yet, but I'm happy to respond.
Well,
right
we can
here.
Respond right here, because by the time you respond, this will go up. But anyway, I mean, he pointed out, and I agree with him, because I've clearly fallen into the same category.
Makes me so impatient.
This notion of the fact that, you know, Beverly Cleary, Judy Blume, and the like, you know, as a boy, I read these as much as I read The Witch Way and the Choose Your Own Adventure and the, like, crazy little pulp science fiction and the Juvenalia by Heinlein. This was stuff that we all read. There were spinning racks at the library where you would, like, you know, there was a limited number of books. You would read all the books, and you would have to read all the Beverly Clearys and the Judy Blumes.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I read this stuff too, so what's up? I mean, and in fact, at one point in my teenage years, I had the long hair, which, so I could hypothetically be one of those two girls on the cover with a book up in the air like that. So I must go ahead and challenge your notion of gender roles prescribed to these particular books. Well, I mean, I understand
that's,
you're
that's
right.
That's actually not my notion. It's funny. It's so funny, like, because it seems like when I read, what's his actual name? I don't want to keep saying M.A.
Michael.
Yeah. Sorry, I knew that.
I just couldn't
remember whether it was Michael or Matthew, so I didn't get it wrong. It's funny because whenever, I never said that. I mean, they put the girls on the cover, which is fine with me. I mean, as it happens, you know, it's like, I feel like there's two points here. You know, some men are saying, well, we read these books too, to which my response is, terrific. Yeah. You know what I mean? I think that's
we want
right.
to be part of the party here, Lizzie.
But you are part of the party. Just buy my book and read it. How are you not? I never said.
Oh, for example.
It says we never stopped reading. It doesn't say girls.
But
it doesn't
still,
say the XX's never
but
stopped.
But when you go ahead and write about flowers in the attic and say, well, this is the quintessential scene about the man coming home to drink his beer, not all the men who worked in the mines came home and were brutal people like that, Lizzie. I mean, I'm reading this and I'm saying to myself, well, you know, men and women don't fall into those.
Are you just
things.
Mad at me because, like, you think I hate men?
No, I don't think you hate men. I'm just thinking that some of these occasional generalizations that pop up in the course of this book likewise fall into these occasional generalizations that we boys growing up did not, in fact, read. I mean, I'll tell you, and in fact, you didn't even bring up Mary Rogers, who
you
I was
are so freaked
of.
Out about this. I write one book about girls. I
read books with girls in them. I love the books with girls
There's
in them. Just
no...
as many other boys did.
No. And I think that's terrific, and I think those boys should read my book. I mean, I think it's wonderful that boys read these books, but I do think, I mean, here's my issue. I feel like it's like this weird affirmative action thing. It's like, okay, so you take women writers, you ghettoize them, you push them into YA, you don't fucking pay attention to girls in classrooms, you don't teach them math. So we read all these books. We enjoy this. This is our private world that we have. Then I write a book about it, and men are like, what about us? And it's like, listen, and it's like, yes. To the individual man, I say, of course you're included. I think it's wonderful that you read these books. But it's also like, whenever you do have a ghetto, you know, there's both exclusion and inclusion, you know, in the ghetto. So it's like when men are like, why aren't we included in this? It's like, well, how about this? You know what you have? You have the New York Times Book Review. So I hope you enjoy that.
I'm not in the New York Times Book Review. I'm never going to be in the New York Times Book Review. Hey.
But it's like this idea that men are getting neglected. And I think Michael would, you were just feeling personally left out. But I think
Michael was too.
I know.
Yeah.
We
love
nice.
These books.
It's so
yeah.
sweet. But I don't know why you're feeling left out. Did you want a boy on the cover too? Like, I don't know where the...
No, it didn't matter. I'm telling you. Like, in fact, I was going to bring up Mary Rogers earlier.
It's like, I didn't break your fingers. You can pull out the typewriter and write an essay. And I would love that. And I actually did invite, I have invited men to write for Fine Lines. Absolutely. And as it happens, they either haven't wanted to or they've been busy. But like, you know, I mean, I do think though, I mean, I will cop to it. I do think this is a memoir mostly about women, by which I don't mean for women at all, but I do think that these books were mainly a female experience, and it was something we all shared. It was something for us that no one knew anything about. You know, I think these writers, these women writers, were sort of often shuttled into YA. They didn't get a lot of credit. And it is true that part of my purpose with this book is to talk about those women and to talk about our time, which is not meant to exclude men at all. You know, it's like if you were involved in it, you know, you were involved in it. But like if I hear someone being like, you know, every single interviewer has asked me about boys. What the fuck do I care about boys? Because I'm kind of like, this is not the experience I'm writing about. And if a male reviewer or a female reviewer wants to write a book about quote-unquote reading for boys, they certainly can, but the problem is most reading is reading for boys.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's what...
No, but the difference, though, here, Lizzie, and this is why I'm being so strenuous.
I just want to point out to the audience, Ed is pointing at me right now.
No,
he is looking
I'm
at me.
Very passionate
he is
about this particular topic.
He is pointing his finger at me. He's going
to I'm not trying to be a school
whip
mom,
out
although,
a rod
hey, I can
like,
be a school mom.
Smack my hand in a second.
The point I'm trying to make here is you mentioned the noun ghetto earlier.
Yes.
And for some of us boys, who, for example, Mary Rogers, who I've been wanting to, obviously, I really have to bring her up, because Freaky Friday,
yeah.
I read that as a boy, it's provided a great insight into mother-daughter relationships that, as a boy, was revolutionary to me. It helped me to understand girls at the time.
Right.
And so, as such, I was part of that ghetto. And boys often quietly discussed
books like Murray Rogers, although Judy Blume was fair game for everybody. And so as such,
and
I think
Judy Blume wrote a lot of books about boys. I mean, Super Fudge.
Yes, she did.
You know, and then there's also Sport. You know, Louise Fitchew. Sport was one of my favorite books. Mm. I loved Sport. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but it is. I am sad that just time constraints while I was writing prevented me from having just the time to get Sport in there, because I just love that book. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, but anyway, the point I was trying to make was essentially that, you know, we were part of that ghetto too without any, I mean, with complete deference to the fact that, yes, it's a man's world or a boy's world, and
that's a pretty big fact.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, with complete deference to the fact that we have to breathe air.
What I'm proposing here is that there was a scenario here in our childhood where, in fact, gender lines didn't have to be, you know, they were very fuzzy and blurred at the time, and there wasn't so much of a kind of
True.
Yeah.
No, that is actually true, and that is very, very true, and something I talk about in the book a little bit, that when we were going up in, I do think there was less emphasis on, like, boys do this, girls do that, in the way that we explicitly understand it now.
Yeah.
But and it's true, we all were on soccer teams together. I mean, there was a way in which the sexes mixed.
Yeah.
You know, we all wore the same clothes, which boys and girls don't do anymore.
Yeah.
You know, until puberty, you half the time you really couldn't tell the difference between a boy and a girl. You never see that now. It was very common in the 70s and 80s. And I do think that's true. But I also think, you know, that these books, there were still ways in which, I mean, you know, when I was growing up, you know, we had to practice in the gym in the bad times. And, you know, no one tried to make, you know, even when I was in college, it was hilarious. I mean, I remember there would be these, you know, trivia competitions, and the men, they were always surprised when I knew anything. I just was like, who raised you? Do you really, still think girls don't know as much as you? And, you know, I knew more than them. But, like, this is, you know, there was still, and this is now 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And that has mostly gone away. But even now, I mean, I guess I know that it exists so strongly because I've worked in teen publishing for a long time. Teen publishing is female publishing, mostly female field. Because, you know, it's just tiring in publishing to, frankly, I don't know if you know this, but, you know, in publishing, men get, they really do. It's one of the last bastions of useless men getting promoted above women.
I believe, constantly.
I mean, really, to a humorous extent.
Yeah.
You're like, oh my God, I can't believe you guys
still do this.
I
mean, we've seen with the layoffs recently, too.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's absurd. You know, after like 3 years working in it, I was like, well, this is crazy. You know, I'm not going to do this. This is actually difficult to take. I'm not going to stay in this. And so you will find in teen publishing and in women's publishing, I do think women gravitate towards there because they're like, listen, I'm going to make money and be the boss. I don't want to be stuck, you know, working under some idiot all the time. Not that all men who work in publishing are idiots. I saw this happen to a disheartening extent, and it was fascinating. But when I talk about this book, you know, I'll be interested to see what reception it gets because, you know, when I used to write those teen books, when I was a master's student at Hopkins, I wrote all of those teen books. The degree of, like, snideness, I mean, and by the way, those are genre fiction, I mean, a person can be snide about them if they feel like it, but the idea was just, ugh, you're writing for teens, you're writing for girls, stupid, stupid, stupid. And I was like, okay, stupid, let's see who still has a career in 10 years and who was forced to go become a lawyer because they couldn't get a job. You know, and it really is astounding, like, the way it's not just men, but I'll, like, you know, men's eyes will really glaze over if you talk about it.
But is that so much patriarchal or just general elitism? That's
no,
the question.
No, it's just patriarchal.
You know?
It's totally
you actually
sexist.
Believe that it's,
oh,
it's
yeah.
patriarchal.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah. This idea that, you know, part of the reason I wanted to write this book is that there's this assumption all of these books were about boys and hair. And of course they're not at all. And you know that because you've read them all.
But I'm not the only boy.
No, I know you're not.
This,
well, you're not the patriarchy. You're an individual.
Yeah.
But I think in general that's, it's fascinating in all that we've supposedly come forth as a society, it's really fascinating that if you say teen books, people will automatically think girls and stupid if they don't know anything
even
about
them.
Even
for Harry Potter?
Well, I think...
Or even Goosebumps for that matter.
Yeah, well, Harry Potter has a male lead. I mean, I don't see... You know, not,
or
not
even that, going back to the Oz books, one might argue. In fact, that was the first book I read. I thought Dorothy was totally punk rock,
yeah.
And it never occurred
although
to me.
Although
yeah.
those... I don't think you would consider... The Oz books sort of, to me, don't actually... I mean, I read them too, but they don't actually fit into YA, even in a way that, like, the Narnia books do. But I just mean... I mean, the point of this book for me was just there is a particular school of literature... That's really wonderful. It's a lot of wonderful work occurred here, and it gets no credit.
Yeah.
And I do think, I mean, I think if you sit me down and ask me, I'll say, oh, why doesn't it get any credit? Oh, because it's female authors. That's why it doesn't get any credit. It's because it's books by women for girls. That's,
I don't know. I think it has to do with this elitism. I think we differ probably on our perspectives, but
Yes, you're right. There,
it's genre ghettoization.
It's certainly that as well, but part of, yes. Done. I agree. But I think part of the reason that the elitism occurs is because it's by women. I mean, I think that's automatically... What women do is automatically shuttled into mid-list work. And what men do is often mid-list stuff too, but it's not called that. I mean, there's even a number of books published this year where I was just like, I had read it, you know, I read it too, I got it in the mail, I read it, and I was just like, this is not an interesting book, there's nothing interesting about it, there's nothing interesting about the author, except that it's a young man, and I can't believe it's getting a page in the Times. This is not even where there's like, this is arguably an interesting book.
I will agree with you there. I will agree with you totally
like, it's
there.
It's just like, what year is this? This is insane. Not that other book reviews don't do a wonderful job, and there's actually, I shouldn't be critical because there's a lot of wonderful organs that do great work and are just interested in books in general, but you see it happen over and over again, what's taken seriously and what's not taken seriously, and it is sort of astonishing that, like, Jacob Have I Loved is a great book by any standard, and it has won prizes for children, but, you know, you could have published that as a book for adults, and it wasn't, it was just fine. But it wasn't, you know what I mean? Whereas, you know, Portnoy's Complaint is. Those books have the same scope. That's a boy, you know?
But on the other hand, let's look at Judy Blume's Wifey.
Rudy's a boy who fucks a piece of liver, so there is sort of that.
But Judy Blume's Wifey, here is a situation in which you have a narrative with a dark reactionary streak because the woman gets punished with gonorrhea for daring to have affairs with other men. And while it has the, quote, happy ending, I am nevertheless troubled from a after the third wave situation. This is really, really troublesome, I think.
I always actually did. I never read her getting the clap as, like, a punishment. Who does she get that from again? Does she get it from Shep? I can't remember who gives her gonorrhea. But you have to remember with Norm, she's already suffering from hysterical vaginitis.
Yeah,
because she
doesn't
want to sleep with her husband. So it's more, and you see that also in Kinflix, which I reread for Shelf Pleasuring, that there's this whole concept of, I didn't actually take that as a punishment. I took that as a sign of, like, women are having a hard time getting satisfaction. It's very, this is right now an uncomfortable role. I don't like fucking my husband. My lover gives me clap. What am I supposed to be doing? And I think a lot of the books I covered for Shelf Pleasuring, the era they exist in, is really, it was an era of women being like, where is there a place for me? What is the place for me? What am I supposed to be a wifey? Am I supposed to be someone's lover? And what's interesting to me, I mean, this is actually a whole different topic, but, you know, or you take like memoirs of an ex-prom queen. What they are is a series of women trying to find themselves. And every single lover is, you know, every single male role doesn't complete something. But not in a bad way. It's usually, like, in a funny way. Like, I always thought that gonorrhea was kind of funny. Is that what I'm saying?
I was always, I mean, you know, and I'm probably more bothered by it as an adult, but it just struck me as the kind of the punishment. I mean, it's the classic sort of trope of, like, oh, yes, she had it coming, so therefore she gets the disease.
No. I thought it was good because it actually just served as a way for her to finally talk with Norm. you know, once she, and it's funny actually, but to give your husband gonorrhea is sort of a funny, it was sort of more ludicrous than anything. And then Norm opened up about, you know, his last relationship, and it actually served as the way for them to start to understand each other.
Yeah.
So maybe that's my personal take, that I took that as sort of burlesque. Yeah. Versus a punishment, because it does have a happy ending.
It does have a happy ending.
You know, and she's certainly not punished. She doesn't.
Pretty Woman had a happy ending too.
No, it didn't. She doesn't.
By the standards of what happy endings are considered.
No,
by the patriarchal overlords.
No, in this case, Sandy's happy ending is that she takes a part time job. She's going to take a part time job. Norm is going to start giving her head. That's pretty good.
That's a good. Progress,
that's good.
Yeah.
They know each
but
other.
But why can't Norm give her cunnilingus?
No, that's what I mean.
Oh yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, sorry.
I was being feminist.
Yeah.
Norm agrees to start doing that. She tells him they proceed to. You know, they're sleeping in the same bed. They like their children. She actually, I feel like, what I loved actually about the end of Wifey is that Norm, and I think I wrote about this, Norm could have been made the enemy, but he wasn't. It's this idea of like, listen, women are asked to be in these limited roles. But actually, that's a very understanding book towards men. Because it's like, yeah, like, your husband is obsessed with, like, you know, the dog shit. And, like, you know, he is very anal. But he's also a nice man and a good man. And you can have a good marriage together. He's a human being, too. He's not the enemy. And I liked that about that book. And I felt like that was actually often the case with these books. Whereas you take something like Judith Krantz, the man is the enemy or the lover, because
yeah.
It's more genre and funny. But these books were more nuanced, I felt, about the roles of men and women. You know, which is why, I mean, maybe it's not coming across that way when I write about that in my column, but maybe that's something you're bringing to it.
Well, we're all bringing our own particular perceptions to it. I actually wanted to ask you about your observation in relation to Island of the Blue Dolphins.
Yes.
You point out that you don't know what's worse, the propensity of actors who speak in English accents in period pieces, or, in fact, these static Native American characters who maintain their internal narrative of effectless formality.
Yeah.
Now, I should point out that perhaps Sherman Alexie has probably solved the latter problem.
Yeah.
So thereby, this demonstrates, well, we have had advancements in what has now become YA. I'm wondering, going back to this question of Wifey, whether we have seen enough developments in the course of the YA genre so that we have more nuance atop nuance.
No, well, I actually, I think these books were extraordinarily nuanced. And I don't know, I mean, I'm trying to actually read more YA nowadays, the YA from today. But I think what was interesting about this period was like how nuanced it was. And I do think it was because the authors were not writing with intent, you know, what we were talking about before.
Yeah.
Like, how can you be strategic towards a market that doesn't exist about a book that has no reason to exist? You know, you can't. So they were really just sort of writing what was fun for them. And when you do that, in general, you get nuance when you write. And, you know, the fact of what you're supposed to be writing can be kind of an imposition.
Yeah.
And you see the same thing in blogs, actually, you know, or at least the beginning blogs. It's a new form. So actually people developed a kind of writing that was new, you know, so and different and had its own rules. And some people objected. You know, and some people didn't object. I don't think I'm doing a good job of answering this question.
No, if you're asking me,
is YA more nuanced nowadays?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think it's nuanced. I think maybe, I mean, this may just be because it's the span of my life.
Yeah.
But which is why I see it this way. But I do think our society, I was answering some questions for Teen Reads, and they were saying, you know, what lessons do you think YA is giving girls? And I was like, you know, I think life is kind of hard. I mean, I know in my day, my old day.
In our day.
I mean, there were certainly ways in which just as a woman, you were just totally, just openly discriminated against, which is actually something that happened to me so seldom. I noticed it when it did, because it actually happened very seldom. And it's still a shock to me when it does, which is still seldom. Because, you know, I don't invite it at all. So when I think it happens to me less often. But I think nowadays it's so hard to be a girl. It's like they're supposed to wear makeup. There's so much now about being pretty and appealing to men. So everybody is apparently supposed to do it from the age of 7 onward. This was not a pressure we had. We actually much more had. If there was anything, it was like the films where it's like there's the pretty girl. And everybody wants to be the pretty girl, maybe. You know, you have that archetype of the pretty girl in the class, the fat girl in the class, you know, the jock, the loner, the outsider. So, like, you know, and the books tended to revolve around those, but there was no way in which every girl was supposed to be the pretty girl. You know, so there was, you know, we didn't wear makeup. We didn't do any of that stuff. And I think we weren't supposed to be sophisticated. We weren't supposed to want to help the homeless. You know, we weren't supposed to be these little adults, to be as interesting as adults, to be... And I think probably some people felt that pressure in their own families, but now when I see it, they talk about kids, you know, going to Bali, and if you ask people what their kids are doing, their lives are so much more interesting than my life has ever been. And I don't think it's good. I may be wrong. Maybe it's wonderful and world-changing and it's great. I think it's terrible. I think as a kid, your life should be a mix of being productive, but you shouldn't have to be such a productive, well-rounded individual. That's crazy.
We may be straying
into straying.
Naomi Wolf territory, so, which is totally
does
cool.
Does Naomi Wolf talk about
that? Well, sort of. We're getting into kind of beauty mythic sort of territory.
No, I know she talked about having to be a perfectly presented person, but yeah. She was talking about adult women.
That's true.
She was objecting to adult women supposed to be doing that. I'm talking about teens.
But that does filter down to teens eventually, particularly the last 10 years.
The last 10 years, and that's really what I mean, that it's shocking to me. And I mean, that's why I'm interested. I mean, I feel like with women, at least it's your own responsibility, reject it if you want, you're a grown-up.
Yeah.
But with these teens, like, I don't know if you read that article on Newton High, like, 10 years ago, or Newton South, whatever the big school is there. I was like, Jesus Christ, I couldn't handle this load. You know, the psychic load, the workload. Why are they making teenagers do this? It doesn't seem...
They're training them for their jobless capacity in the future, in which they'll be working long hours for no pay. That's what they're doing. Yeah.
You know, I mean,
it's actually good for the country, because this is all about slave labor in the future.
Well, you know, if it has
a point... Well, starts with the kids.
With Russia and China, at least, you know, it's like, yeah, we're training them to build bridges and bombs, dumbass. There's a reason. You know, we're training them to make a nation. And at least that, I'm like, well, that's hard. But it has a purpose.
Yeah.
But training, how do well-rounded individuals do anything for anybody? They don't. They.
Well, okay. Let's go. Let's just roll back just a little bit. Back to the initial thread here, which was okay. The thesis here that we were discussing was that publishers didn't set nearly as many conditions in terms of marketing a book as they, you know, back then, as they do now. So authors were therefore more liberated in their capacity to write about numerous topics and to therefore be nuanced about their narratives. And so I guess the question is at what point do you think was the cutoff time when suddenly, like, oh, well, hey, YA is something we can actually go ahead and market to the kids and really make some money
Reagan.
Here. And
Like I would say, you know, my... Sweet Valley High. So, I mean, there's always been, although in a way I want to separate Sweet Valley High, because people have always understood series fiction was very marketable. And in every, like, I'm rereading right now the lesbian pulp anthology, you know, and lesbian pulps were like big. Like, there's always been this idea of we can market series or ideas to people. So done. So maybe I would say, well, The Babysitter's Club was a series too. But I think. When did they decide? I think you would have to ask somebody else. I really don't know. I mean, obviously the Gossip Girls was one big iteration. Sweet Valley High was another big iteration. I can't remember the Kavya Visinoathan book. There was that big period of chick lit for teens about 5 years ago, which has died off a little bit. But I can't remember. There was the one that started it. I mean, obviously Meg Cabot's books are very popular, you know. So I think maybe it was that. I mean, you would actually have to ask someone from the industry, because this I don't know. But if you mean in the scope of my book, when did that happen?
No, I'm just a sort of general question as to when you thought that the sort of, I guess, more pristine era that you dwell upon in these columns and in this book sort of just stopped. I mean, like, what is the era that you would, you know, not write about at a certain particular time?
I think it was when the Babysitter's Club and R.L. Stine started, which is nothing is wrong with those books, but I have read them, and they are fun. You know what I mean? I mean, I would read, my sister read Babysitter's Clubs, and I would certainly read them.
So did mine, so.
Yeah, yeah, so I definitely read them. They were different, though. They weren't so, they were written in a less wacko time, and they were less wacko, not on purpose. Yeah. I think, I would say they were more pristine, because they just were. They were just more fettered. They were written to an audience, and they were appropriate. And the books, there is nothing appropriate about any book in Fine Lines, technically, really. Like, for the most part, they are all completely inappropriate. Maybe something like Nothing's Fair in Fifth Grade also started it. That was, you know, those were books that had less, even though that's a book about, you know, cruelty, the mother is pretty cruel, you can see in that consciousness of that novel something so different from Daughters of Eve. You know, it's really kind of like, we're writing about girls in school and how they're mean to fat girls and how moms can be mean to fat girls. And, you know, it's sort of out there in a way that it's not in many of the other books.
So comfortable books or nuanced books come from comfortable times, you would say?
Yeah, books you can teach.
Yeah.
Books you can teach. And I wrote a little bit in my intro, not that these other books are not taught, I think they were, I shouldn't, you know, English teachers always teach any book, so I'm not, but, you know, we read in my high school, like, The Red Pony, and Of Mice and Men, and the, what's the Hemingway book, would I want to say The Big Fish?
Farewell to...
No, not a farewell,
farewell to... Farewell to Fish, yeah.
No, The Old Man and the Sea. Yeah. The Old Man and the Sea, and, like, you know, Orwell.
The Sun Always Sets in the Sea.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, and like, To Kill a Mockingbird, and which is actually a very nuanced book, but, like, I was... There's someone who's making a documentary about To Kill a Mockingbird, that, and I was talking about it, and I was saying how I was so much more interested in the part about Scout in the beginning, and how lonely she is, and how the quietness of our childhood and needing to be a spy and this distant father. They always teach, like, the court case and, like, justice and, you know, and that is so much less interesting to me than the beginning with Scout and her friends and the formation of her world.
Shaking like the devil when she lets me go. Got a new place and how it's so much better.